Welcome, everybody, to Breaking Kayfabe. I'm your host, Jeff Bodron, and I have been let out of the fucking cage today, Barry. I'm salty. It's my 58th fucking birthday. We got people delaying our podcast. Barry, oh, it's the Midnight Rambler from Alhambra, or Ambler. I fucked that up. What's going on, Barry?
This is awesome.
The line was going to be, it's the Midnight Rambler from Ambler, PA.
And you said
you can correct that Alhambra. Up.
Where the fuck did you get Alhambra from?
Hey, I don't know.
Sweet Lou, are you there? Sweet Lou? Knock, knock.
Who is
you are?
Larry? He's busy talking to fucking Larry.
Is he? No. Lou? Lou, would you like to join me in a rendition of Happy Birthday to our better... I guess I was going to say our better half, but...
No, you're right. You're right.
No, but it's like the better third, because you're not a half. I guess you could be a half, you know? All right. What do you think, Lou? Do we sing Happy Birthday to Jeff?
People have been calling on Lou for better, a while.
We
Barry, why don't you let Lou sing with his dulcet tones?
All right, Jeff, you got to be quiet for a second. I know you're just let out of a cage. You're fired up like no one's business. Lou, and you've got the voice, Lou. I bet you could sing. You're like a Frank Sinatra type, I bet. Am I right?
An occasional crooner, sure.
All right. Should we give it a shot?
Or an Al Martino?
An Al Martino.
Thank you with that 1950s, early 60s reference there. Thank
this
you.
This is going to be a show. Something just tells me.
My parents popped for that reference. I can tell you that. My dad went Al Martino.
Yeah, for the Patreon subscribers, I'll be singing Volare. Yeah.
All right, a one, a two, a three.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Booker man. Happy birthday to you. Okay.
Boom.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. Let me say it the way I meant to say it. It's the Midnight Rambler from Ambler, PA, my co-host, the returning Barry Rose. We've had several guest appearances. We had Harry, Larry, Mary, Sherry, and Barry. Oh, you're back, Barry. Welcome back.
Sorry. Yes, I know. Yeah, I was in Alhambra, so I got delayed. Yeah, but I'm back now. I'm back. But Jeff, it is your 58th birthday. I actually have a birthday in a few days.
59?
So nice. I'll be
You're
56.
No Greg Good, my friend, who's also sharing a birthday today.
Yeah, exactly. Greg Good. And there were some other people, too. Probably thousands of people across the world, but I hope you have a great birthday, Jeff. This has been a great show. Lou, great job today.
Goodbye, everybody.
That's it. We'll see y'all.
It's an abbreviated version of Breaking Kayfabe. So today, folks, barring our time constraints, because quite frankly, my family's taking me to dinner tonight, we are going to be looking at a lot of different topics. We're going back to our matches from the 90s, as represented by my man Tom Haley.
Tom Hale.
What the fuck, Tom? I'm sorry I screwed up your name. We're going to a match from Starrcade 93 as stunning Steve Austin takes on Dustin Rhodes. That's the match that Tom suggested. So we're going to go with that one, talk about that one. We're going to be offering our top five movie suggestions for Halloween. We have a special guest top five that Barry doesn't even know about that I'm going to be throwing in there. Yes, indeed. We're going to be having an interview with Larry Hamill. Folks, I'm going to guarantee this interview is not going to take more than 20 minutes because this fucker thinks he needs to get himself over. So we're going to cut him short at 20 minutes. So Larry, recently in the news, Barry, why don't you tell the good folks about that?
Yeah. So if you happen to listen to Jim Cornette, I believe it was on the drive-through last Tuesday, there were a series of tweets in which Larry was defending and recommending that Jim give Orange Cassidy, the slacker Orange Cassidy of AEW, a second look so that he could actually appreciate Orange Cassidy. And quite frankly, Jim did not react too well to that. So we do have the tweets. We also have Jim's comments, and we're going to have Larry on the show a little bit later on today, Jeff.
Yes, he will be defending it. I believe he compared him to, was it Frank Martinez, Frank Hester? No, there was somebody else he compared Orange Cassidy to, Barry. Who was it?
It was Jack Briscoe.
A fair comparison, apparently, in Larry's mind. We will discuss this topics among others. Barry, before we get started, I don't know if you had a chance to look at this, Barry. I sent it to you today. Rolling Stone Mag. We haven't talked music lately, Barry. I thought we'd talk for a couple minutes here about music. Rolling Stone Magazine, fine scribes that they are, came out with a top 100 best singers of all time. Now, by singers, I'm assuming that they're going to mean people that have outstanding musical voices, a octave range, if you will. Now, let's be honest. Barry, throw out your favorite all-time group or singer. Throw it out.
Well, yeah, he's not going to be on there, which is okay. Probably Danny Elfman. But that's fair. But let's just say the person I would think is the greatest singer of all time as far as rock and roll, I'm going to go with Freddie Mercury.
Okay, and that's a fair. That's one that I would certainly, if not my number one, it'd be two or three at the very least. Freddie Mercury coming in here at number 18. So we're going to discuss this.
I'm looking at the list. What in God's name is number 97?
That is Joe Cocker. They edited Joe Cocker's name out.
Okay. Yeah. There you go.
I guess it's fucking Joe Cocker to you and me. Yeah. Who, by the way, should be higher based on his vocal stylings. Okay. Now, there are people that are on this list, Barry. And for the purpose of this, because, you know, we don't want to do the 100th episode of the 605 podcast, 5-hour special here. But, you know, what we're looking at here is a top 100 list. So how about for today's purpose, we'll just do 51 through 100 and we'll just go through and say in or out, whether or not you feel this person is one of the 100 best singers of all time. And based on some of the names that are on this list, by the way, this is not strictly, folks, just for your edification, not just your 100 best rock singers of all time. They have included blues singers, pop singers, all different stylings. We may have a few country singers in here, okay? So we're putting in the vocal stylings. Now, this has nothing to do with whether or not you're a great rock musician, whether or not you're a great writer of songs, stylist. This is talking about your fucking voice here, people. So guess what? When you're talking about great voices, Tom Waits, he has a very distinctive voice, but is he one of the greatest 100 voices? I think not. Bob fucking Dylan, guess what, is in the top 10. Come on. Bob Dylan is an iconic figure, one of the most important figures in rock history. Great writer. I'm not a big fan of Bob Dylan, but I understand his importance in the history of music. But his voice is not one of the top 10 of all fucking time. Give me a break. Barry, are you ready to start this list? We're going to go quick here.
Yeah, and then, look, this list makes no sense to me because I'm looking at number 92, which is Morrissey, and number 99, which is Steven Tyler of Aerosmith, and you're going to tell me that those two guys with those distinctive voices, this is a list. Look, this is a bunch of fucking pseudo-intellectuals sitting around a room having $6 lattes, fucking pumpkin-spiced enema bullshit fucking lattes, and they're coming up with this fucking stupid list. I mean, give me a fucking Mariah Carey. You're right about Tom, you know, Art Garfunkel at 86. The fuck?
Yeah. So Barry's not the only one feeling salty today, folks. Let me just say, because I'm not like a Barry get all the fucking credit for his cursing like some of you assholes like to do. I want to get some fucking credit for cursing on that list too. Okay, so let's start off with Mary J. Blige. A fine R&B singer. I got no complaints with her being on the list. She's got a good voice. Steven Tyler at 99. No problem with Steven Tyler. Probably should be higher. He's got tremendous range. Stevie Nicks got a distinctive vocal styling. I think Stevie Nicks, let me just say, should be higher than some of the women that are on this list. There are women, of course, also on the list. And I think Stevie has a better voice than some of them. Joe Cocker, he should be on the list. Probably should be higher. B.B. King is number 96. Now, B.B. King, very raspy, you know, distinctive styling. I don't know, you know, guitarist? Yeah, I'd put B.B. King. I don't know if I'd put B.B. King's voice in the top 100, Barry. What do you think?
I not at all. He wasn't known for his voice, per se. Yeah. He was known for the blues. That's ridiculous.
Yeah. Patti LaBelle at 95. Patti LaBelle, very distinctive voice. She hits all kind of octaves. She has a tremendous voice.
Yeah.
I got no problem with Patti LaBelle being on this list, down in this range, okay? Next, 94, a particular favorite of mine. Now, I'm a big 70s AM radio guy. I love some of the – Karen Carpenter had an amazing voice. Now, you would never hear anybody in rock music say that because, of course, Karen Carpenter was doing kind of AM radio dreck that people – it was not cool to like Karen Carpenter. But if you listen to Karen Carpenter sing Superstar – oh, my God. Her vocal range is amazing. It's an incredible voice. She absolutely belongs in this list. Annie Lennox. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah. You know, if I was going top 100, sure. I don't know. Yeah. I don't know.
Okay. So Morrissey, does he belong on the list, Barry?
Absolutely. And Morrissey belongs. He has such a distinctive voice and it's smooth. His voice is smooth and it flows. I would put Morrissey top 25.
Really? Okay.
Yeah.
Levon Helm, of course, iconic member of the band, Bob Dylan's backup group. I don't know that Levon Helm belongs on this list, Barry.
You know what? I couldn't tell you what I know what his voice sounds like, so I don't
okay.
know.
Okay. So now, 90, the Everly Brothers. The Everly Brothers had great voices, but they're a duo.
Yeah. Right.
You know, I could see them putting one of these guys on there because they did have really distinctive voices. Okay, next. 89, Solomon Burke. Who the hell
fuck
is Solomon Burke?
I have no fucking idea.
Who the fuck is Solomon Burke? That's probably somebody. I'm going to go out there and say McAdam has all his fucking albums, including the live Tokyo release that was never published in the United States. That's the kind of shit McAdam is. That's right. I fucking said it. Willie Nelson at 88. What do you think?
Well, you know what? Willie's voice obviously is unique. I love Willie Nelson. So you know what? I'm absolutely fine that he's on the list.
Okay. Don Henley at 87.
Should be higher.
Huge asshole, but an incredible talent. And you know, I got no problem. Okay. So Lou telling us that Solomon Burke is an R&B god. He's worth tracking down. So contact John McAdam. I'm sure he's got the bootleg shit. So next, Art Garfunkel at 86.
You know what? Sure.
Not a big Art Garfunkel fan?
Not a big Art. Not at all. Not at all.
You weren't in Central Park in 82 when Simon and Garfunkel had their reunion?
No, I was not there.
Okay. Sam Moore, a really influential voice in R&B in the 60s and maybe even before.
Yeah, I think he actually belongs. He does have an amazing voice.
Yeah. Darlene Love at 84.
Sure. I'm fine with that.
Hattie Smith at 83.
I don't think Patti Smith has a great voice. I don't think she.
And
now,
see,
known.
Here's one of these things. You know, she was like a punk rock goddess. Yeah. Very great writer of punk songs. Again, the voice, I'm not thinking it. Okay, so we talked about Tom Waits. 81. Talk about your distinctive voices, Barry. John Lee Hooker. Boom, 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 boom. I don't know. Great voice. Tremendous styling. Very influential R&B guy. I don't know if he's got a real distinctive voice. I just don't know if it's one of the 100 greatest.
John Lee Hooker from the Blues Brothers,
of course,
too, Jeff.
And he's tapping them snakeskin or whatever shoes during the flea market as they roll up to the Aretha Franklin joint. So let's see. Frankie Valli had an amazing voice. And I think he definitely belongs on this list.
Yeah, sure.
Not a big Frankie fan?
Not really. Not really. Yeah.
I'm going to call Frankie. He's going to say, fuck you, Barry.
Yeah. What's about 100 now? He can say it.
He's about 5'2". I think you could take him.
5'2" and 100 years old. Sure. I got him.
He's probably still singing in the casinos in New Jersey. Yeah. So Mariah Carey. Now, do you think Mariah belongs?
Well, look, like Mariah Carey, hate Mariah Carey. Don't like her style of music by any stretch. I think we can safely say, though, her voice is something that is completely unique, that really she hits notes in that octave range that other people can't. I would say she absolutely would deserve it.
Yeah, she absolutely belongs. And again, I'm not a huge fan, but I know her voice. It's very distinctive and it has incredible range and probably should be higher, quite frankly.
Yep.
So Sly Stone, Sly Stone, very influential in the late 60s. I just don't remember Sly Stone going, oh, fuck yeah, what a voice.
Yeah, no, I don't. I would have to agree with you on that.
Okay. 77, Merle Haggard.
I don't know a lot of Merle Haggard.
Okey from Muskogee? Really?
Yeah.
So, a very distinctive voice. I don't know that it would strike me as being one of the, it's a very distinctive voice, but there are other voices in country music. If I was going to throw in some country names that I would say, oh, yeah, that definitely belongs. Matter of fact, we're about to get to one. So 76, Steve Perry. I not only believe Steve Perry should be on this list, he should be higher.
I would have to agree. And I want to say the guy who replaced him in Journey, that sounds identical to him.
Arnel Pineda.
Why isn't he on this fucking list? Because they sound absolutely the same.
Yeah, you know why? Because Tom fucking Waits is on this list. That's why. Number 75, Burke. I know you're a punk guy, Barry. Iggy Pop.
I love Iggy Pop, and I could listen to Iggy Pop. He doesn't belong on a list of the top 100 voices ever. Not at all.
Okay, James Taylor.
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah, I think James Taylor, a very good writer, had some really good hit records and stuff like that. But his voice, you know, the vocal range doesn't strike me as, yeah, no, he absolutely belongs in this list. So I don't really think he. Now, 73, Dolly Parton, going back to the country. Dolly Parton's voice and the range that she can hit absolutely belongs on this list because, you know, not plastic surgery Dolly. I'm talking right. late 60s into the 70s, you know, right before like 9 to 5. That Dolly Parton had an amazing range. And I know people hate to hear me say this because it's like taboo. I'm saying something that should never be said. I like her version of, you know, the song more than the what do you call
Whitney Houston? No.
Yeah, the Whitney Houston version of the song.
Yeah. You know, what was it? What song is that?
Oh, fuck. It's from Best of the
Whorehouse.
I'll
Always Love You.
Yes,
I'll
that one. Love Thank you. Right. I drew a birthday complete fucking blank on that song. But I like Dolly Parton's version because Whitney does, while Whitney has a tremendous voice, and I'm sure we're going to find her somewhere high on this list, she would always do what I call the Whitney Houstonization of the song, where she has to show you the range that she has. Mariah Carey does that shit too. And yes. They go way out there, and it's just like, just fucking sing the song. You know, you don't need to take it. We know you get the voice. Okay.
All right, Jeff. F. Mary Kill.
Well, I may have that later in the show, Barry. So why don't you hold on to that?
Okay. Wow. There you go. I
may have surprised you on that, Mr. Spoiler Alert. So next, 72, John Fogerty. CCR.
Yeah, I mean, I love CCR, and I, you know, does he have one of the top 100 voices of all time for rock and roll?
And not for rock and roll, of all time.
Oh, it, so yeah. We're talking I would
stuff
say
that's
no.
not
I would say
necessarily no. just rock and roll.
Yeah, I would say no.
Okay. So Ronnie, I jumped ahead there. 71, the great Toots Herbert.
I have no idea who.
I'm waiting for Lou to clue us in.
Toots Herbert. Yeah.
As Lou is, I'm sure, doing
he
the Google.
The,
I thought he was one of the Gold Dust Trio. Yeah.
Yeah. Toots Hibbert.
He was. Yeah. He's the guy that sold the promotion to Vince McMahon Sr. Yes. The great Toots Hibbert, ladies and gentlemen.
With Solomon Burke.
I'm sure now when the show comes out, some asshole that I can probably figure out who it's going to be. It's going to put on there, I can't believe you fucking assholes don't know who Toots Hibbert is. Greatest singers of all time.
Who's it going to be, Jeff? Who's it going to be?
I don't know. Is it going to be Nelly or is it going to be Greenbaum? One of those guys.
Yeah.
So, okay. 70, great vocal stylings, very distinctive voice. Greg Allman at 70.
Yeah, I guess so. I don't know.
You know, I can see him being on this list. This might be a little high, but he belongs in the top 100. He had a very distinctive voice. Another great female vocal voice, 69, Ronnie Spector.
I would say yes. I would definitely
agree with very that. Distinctive voice, lots of range. 68, another great distinctive voice, the great Wilson Pickett at 68.
Yeah, I would probably say, I'd go with that.
And 67, Jerry Lee Lewis. Now, here, I don't know if his voice, I mean, he's a great entertainer. I mean, tremendous talent. You know, great movie, Great Balls of Fire with Dennis Quaid. It was a great movie. I loved it. But I just don't know whether that voice is something that's so distinctive that it belongs in the 100 greatest voices of all time. Number 66, of course, the great Tom York.
Yeah, getting back to Dennis Quaid, have you seen him lately, Jeff?
Oh, yeah, this plastic surgery is
Jesus.
Not
it's brutal.
Yeah, I think Meg Ryan called him and suggested it, and he should have hung up the phone. It's not
he absolutely should have. Yeah. Tom York is a great singer. I don't know how much a Radiohead, and I know he's doing a tour in the U.S. right now of his solo stuff. He has a great voice. I don't know if he makes the top 100 or not. I don't know.
Yeah, okay, so next we have, let's see, David Ruffin. From the Temptations.
That I would say yes. I would ask.
Yes, a very distinctive voice. I have no problem with that at all. Now, 64. Yeah, we're going to get fired up on this one, Barry. Axl Rose.
Well, you know, let's be honest, there were, three albums that came out there that set the world on fire, and his vocal stylings were a huge part of that. I don't know if he falls into the top 100, but I could see a case being made for it.
Yeah, he has a very distinctive voice. There's no question about it. He's also an incredibly big asshole. So I'll point the middle finger to Axl fucking Rose. You know, for all you GNR fans, nothing personal. I just think Axel's a complete D-bag. No, he doesn't get it. Distinctive voice, yes. There's no question about that. So 63, Dion.
Dion.
Ric Flair would say yes.
Yeah. I don't know. He's one of those guys, I think, if you were around in the 60s, he certainly can hit the high notes. When we have more time, I actually have a really good Dion and Jerry Lee Lewis story to tell you. Whatever.
It involves a time when you were a server.
No, it doesn't. Really? It's even more exciting. It's when the movie came out.
Tell the story, Barry.
So there was a period when I was taking photographs in New York City and essentially a paparazzi, but I think that's giving myself too much credit by saying that. And I snuck into a party at the Ritz, and the party was for Great Balls of Fire. And a lot of people were there. Winona Ryder was there. Robert Sean Leonard, who I think was dating her at the time. That was a guy that was in that movie with Robin Williams, Dead Poets Society, and also House. And obviously Jerry Lee Lewis. So Dion and Jerry Lee Lewis were at the Ritz, and they were drinking together, and they started performing together. And I got to admit, it was pretty incredible to see it.
All righty.
All right.
Yeah. The most uncomfortable line from Great Balls of Fire.
Does it have to do with a 13-year-old girl?
Yes, it does.
Oh, okay.
There you go. Who's right. Not only 13 years old, she's his cousin.
Right.
Yes, it was a little bit uncomfortable there. So, okay. 62. Again, distinctive voice does not belong in the list of 100 greatest singers. Lou Reed.
No, definitely doesn't belong on the – he's Iggy Pop in a sense. He just – I don't see it. Yeah.
61, a voice that definitely does belong. Roger Daltrey should be higher on this list as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, it definitely should be higher. Roger, I mean, he's iconic too. Yeah, I would agree with that.
Yeah. Now, I'm going to skip 60 for just one second. I'll come back to that. 59, okay. Rod Stewart, a very distinctive voice, one of my favorites. So, of course, I believe that Rod belongs to this list. Maybe a little bit higher. I'm not going to put him in the top five or anything like that, but I think Rod maybe top 30-ish. So I think he's a little bit low. Okay, but between the vocals of Rod Stewart and Roger Daltrey, two, let's be honest, Barry, pretty iconic voices in the history of classic rock, okay? And again, I'm pointing out, this is not necessarily just classic rock or you know, R&B. This is all everything. But the fact that between Rod Stewart at 59 and Roger Daltrey at 61, coming in at number 60, Bjork.
Yeah, so Bjork does have an amazing voice. A lot of it is it's bizarre. Some of her shit's really bizarre.
That's fair.
That's pretty honest too. But her voice is, I mean, it's, you know, she's got a range there that not a lot of people will ever have. I don't know if 60 is fair. I would say top 100, I could see that.
Yeah. Now, I'll tell you, somebody who does have an amazing vocal range, who's at 58, is Christina Aguilera. I got no problem with her being on this list. She's got a tremendous voice.
Yeah. Whatever happened to her? Why isn't she a bigger star?
I think because she became a bigger star.
There you go.
Now, there I am. I'm going to get a note. Baldwin fat shaming again. Let's just say.
Oh, I didn't even. Yes. Took me a second. I didn't even get that.
Okay. You had to think about it there for me.
Is that a
somebody gag? Actually called me out for that because I made a mention of the guy. From, you know, the fucking, what do you call, Breaking Bad joke about Jesse.
Oh, that's right.
Putting on weight. Oh, Baldwin's fat
shaming. Fat shaming. Yes, so fat shaming Jesse Plemons.
She put on a little weight. She's still, Barry, here's a little pun. She's still beautiful. Yeah. Remember that song? Yeah. Okay. So I thought.
I like her. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. No, she's a good looking girl. No question about it.
Yeah.
57, Eric Burdon of the Animals.
I think so.
He belongs here. And 56, Mavis Staples, great voice.
Yep, should be higher, too.
Yeah,
should be higher.
Speaking of people that should be higher, 55, Paul Rogers from Bad Company.
Yeah, solid.
I saw Paul Rogers, let me see, I went out with Apache Bull Ramos, he who shall not be mentioned on this show. I want to say within the last 5 to 7 years, and Bad Company was appearing at the Hard Rock. Actually, the entire concert is on YouTube. It was an amazing concert, a Bad Company at the Hard Rock in Hollywood, Florida. And we were watching the concert, and I'm sitting there going, fucking Paul Rogers is like late 60s, early 70s.
Yeah.
And his voice is amazing for, it's amazing for someone in their 30s or 40s. But for someone of that age, you know, usually, let's be honest, I love Rod Stewart, but his voice is fucking gone. And, you know, but Paul Rogers has not lost his voice, and it's absolutely amazing. 54, lost far too young Luther Vandross. Great voice.
I would say should probably be higher. And I have told the Luther Vandross story here previously, so I won't go over it. But he was actually a really nice guy with a hell of an appetite. And
there you go, fat shaming, Barry.
Yeah, no, he really did have it. That was the whole deal. He had a hell of an appetite. But his voice, I think he's easily top 50, if not even higher than that.
My biggest complaint for Luther Vandross was a personal one. It was a Luther Vandross song that was at my second wedding. 53, Muddy Waters.
I don't, you know what? I'm not sure I've ever sat and listened to a Muddy Waters song, so I don't know. Not qualified, Jeff.
You're going to be criticized by somebody online, I'm sure. Let's see, 52, Brian Wilson.
I don't know. Does Brian Wilson really deserve?
I gotta be honest with you. I don't know that some of the great Beach Boys songs were, you know, I don't know that, you know, because I know, I think God Only Knows is not Brian. I think that's Carl singing that song. And Mike Love is the lead singer on so many of their other classic hits. I mean, Brian Wilson is definitely a Hall of Famer as far as rock musicians, an incredible producer. Of course, he did Pet Sounds, which completely changed things in popular and rock music. But I don't know his voice, and Lou pointing out that Carl probably deserves to be on this list more than Brian. So, you know, I'm going to go with what Lou says there. Okay, finally, we're wrapping up. We'll make this a two-parter, Barry, so we can really stir the pot on the board. We're going to close off here at number 51. That way we'll have the top 50 for next week. 51, a voice that absolutely belongs and probably should be higher, and that is the great Gladys Knight.
Yeah, iconic, great voice. Still has a great voice, too. I heard her on something. It might have been a commercial or something from television, but I still want to know, why did they star out Cock on Joe Cocker? What's that about?
Well, apparently they're worried about a little controversy. If his name was Joe Asshole, they probably would have, I'm sure they would have done that. Gladys Knight, though, let me just say, first of all, great Midnight Train to Georgia, of course, classic song. But also, I have been in a prior trip to the Atlanta area to Gladys Knight's Chicken and Waffle restaurant.
Now we're talking.
There you go. Okay, so Barry, before we go on, Barry, now it's time for a little personal rant from your favorite co-host here.
All right.
Folks, let's talk Kenny Omega. Barry, you've had a chance to see a couple of Kenny Omega matches in the past. Quickly, your thoughts?
He's fantastic. I would say he's top 10 in the world right now for being a professional wrestler.
Okay, I will honestly say, because I think Kenny Omega has had a very limited run this particular year. I don't know
that
he belongs because, they've been putting the promotion together with the other guys, and so he hasn't been working as much. But for the 2 or 3 years before that, Kenny Omega is definitely a top 10 guy in the world for his New Japan stuff. I mean, he was amazing. Now, you can sit there and say that you don't like Kenny Omega's facial expressions. You don't like the whole finger pointing thing that he does. You don't like him running in place sometimes when he's getting ready to do a move. But Kenny Omega had some of the greatest matches over the last 5 years, with Okada, with Naito, with guys like that. He kept the Bullet Club gimmick going. He was a tremendous heel. And I got to tell you something. If there's a moment in time in the last 5 years that popped me as a wrestling fan, it's the first time Kenny Omega in Japan took the house mic at the end of the show, because that's what happens on New Japan shows. When you win the main event, you're given the mic and you can speak to the crowd. And for the first time ever, a gaijin wrestler spoke Japanese to the fans. And the pop that Kenny Omega got from being there, he started living there, he began to speak the language, and the balls it took for that guy to speak Japanese to that crowd and to acknowledge, you didn't think I knew what you guys were talking about and the things you said about me. That was an incredible, incredible moment. Now, that has nothing, of course, to do. That's just a moment in time that I remember. But Kenny Omega is a tremendous wrestler, and he does tremendous stuff. Of course, like anybody else, he's got to be with the right opponent. If he's with a shit opponent, he's going to be shitty, okay? Now, I know that Jim Cornette hates Kenny Omega. Okay, he's made it perfectly clear on his show on numerous occasions. He feels that the match that Kenny Omega had, I don't know, 9 or 10 years ago with the Japanese girl, okay, that is somehow a violation of kayfabe in the highest order, and that he could never be forgiven for that. And if that's the way Jimmy feels, more power to him. I got no complaint, because I'm not here to tell anybody how to feel about anybody. Okay, there are people and guys and women that Barry and I enjoy, and there's people that we don't. And if you disagree with us, that's fine. We're not going to tell anybody the way to think. And I really don't think that Jimmy is telling somebody, hey, I want you to hate Kenny Omega. Okay. And Brian on the show, I don't think Brian's saying, hey, we want you to hate Kenny Omega. They call him Kenny Olivier. Okay. But for those of you out there, whether you're on our board or whether you're on the mothership board, the sycophants, the parrots that feel the need, oh, yeah, Jimmy, you're absolutely right. Yeah, you're right. We hate him. We hate him. And, you know, I saw on a board, comment on the board when someone made an anti-Kenny Omega mention, someone put a meme up of a parrot and said, did Jimmy steal this guy's Facebook page? Is that why he's come? Because, you know what? That's what people are doing. They feel like they need to suck at the teat of Jim Cornette and Brian Last and agree with them just so everybody goes, hey, we're agreeing with you, Jim and Brian. You know, people, come up with a thought of your own. How about that? How about you fucking watch the guy's matches? And if you don't like the guy's match, say, you know what? I heard what Jimmy said, and I agree with Jimmy because I've watched the guy. I took the chance, and I watched the guy to see if I agreed with Jimmy, or God forbid, maybe I disagreed with Jimmy. Because you know what? You're allowed to do that. Matter of fact, I just saw yesterday some guy pointed out that he disagreed with Jimmy on something, and he said, you know what? I looked at it and I disagree with Jimmy, and that's all I got to say. And Jim pointed out, you know what? That's how you have an intelligent, argument or disagreement with somebody, as opposed to saying you're a fucking asshole. I disagree with you. You're completely up. No, I on this particular occasion happen to disagree with Jim. Jim doesn't like Kenny Omega. Guess what? He's entitled to his opinion. I'm sure some people agree with him. But there are also people out there that think that Kenny Omega is an amazing talent and a wrestler. I wish Kenny Omega was wrestling still in New Japan, because he was friggin' amazing. Okay? But if you disagree, take the time yourself. Don't suck at the teat just to kiss ass and try to gain points with Jimmy or Brian or even Barry and I. If you fucking disagree with us, say, you know what? I happen to disagree with you. I understand that you have your own opinion, but guess what, folks? Have your own fucking thoughts. Don't just randomly jump on board someone else's train. Ugh. All right,
Barry. Wow. Thanks. Look at you.
It's my birthday and I'm fired up. I've been let out of the cage.
Yeah, you're bringing it on too. And look, I agree. Look, we were having a discussion today about Joey Ryan, and I don't, you know, for me, I don't care what other people like or what they dislike more. You want to fucking put somebody like Joey Ryan or Marco Stunt on a pedestal. And certainly in Marco's case, that would help, but more power to you. If you like Marco Stunt and that's your favorite wrestler, why should I give two shits? It has nothing to do with the way that I would, you know, anything. So I think Kenny Omega, and again, he's had a quiet year, and a lot of it is he was dormant. I don't think he wrestled for several months. But you go back in his body of work, and I've had this conversation with my son, who is a gigantic Kenny Omega fan, and he's pretty much convinced that Kenny Omega is the best wrestler, the best American or Canadian wrestler in the world currently. I don't know if I necessarily agree with that, but he's a huge fan. But, yeah, you know, whatever. You don't like Kenny Omega, more power to you. But give the guy a chance. As Jeff said, if you haven't seen his matches, check it out. Yes, he did wrestle like a 10-year-old girl. But you got to remember, too, Jim Cornette has accepted paychecks from a company where an 85-year-old woman gave birth to a hand. So, you know, so take everything with a grain of salt. It's all professional wrestling, regardless.
Yeah, that's a key. It's, you know, it's wrestling, folks. You know, yeah. Barry and I were having a conversation about something the other day, and I got off the phone and I was explaining the situation to my wife in the car. And I said, you know what? It's sometimes you just have to say it's wrestling, you know, and you have to understand that which you're dealing with. And you take the good with the bad. And so, you know, if you watch Kenny Omega and you think he's a big pile of steaming horse shit, more power to you. And tell me, but don't say, I think he's a pile of horseshit because, you know, Jim and Brian think that. Think that because that's what you believe. And that was the trouble that I had with some of the stuff I saw posted online. It just seemed like some people, and this is my complaint, some people were just jumping on the bandwagon of Jim and Brian wanting to seemingly appease them. And I don't like that any more than, quite frankly, I want somebody to match. We're reviewing Dustin and Steve Austin. Don't sit there and tell us, oh my God, Jeff and Barry, that was great, and not even have watched the match. You know, I post the match every single week. If you watch it and you think it's a big steaming pile of shit and we said it was great, tell us, hey, you know, when I watch this match, I don't see it. I think you guys missed the boat on this, you know, and explain to us. That's what we have the board for. That's why we like to keep the lines of communication. You know, we don't like to see this same 20 people on there that we seemingly see every day. We encourage new people. And I like when I post something, you know, I posted something yesterday, Barry, about a game from the past where the fields were muddy and, you know, it was just a real old school football thing. And I saw some names commenting and I was like really pleased because they're not the usual names that we see on there. And we happen to have a post from Dave Lamont, who is a broadcaster for ESPN. And he talked about why he feels that they don't have it on there. And he, you know, he certainly makes a fair point for player safety and all this other kind of stuff. And I told him, I said, look, I just liked it because, you know, the aesthetic value of seeing mud on the uniforms and the way that weather can impact either a college football game or an NFL football game. And I like that whole dynamic of football in the snow and that kind of thing. And I like seeing the other voices commenting. And guess what? I didn't agree with Dave Lamont, but I told him, this is why I don't agree with you. I didn't say, oh, Lamont, you're a fucking asshole. I can't believe you said that. You know, and don't do that, or don't jump on board and say, oh, Jeff, I completely agree with you. By the way, what were you talking about again? You know, don't do that. I don't want you to do that. If you want to disagree with me or Barry or, you know, or Brian or Jimmy about something, tell them that you don't agree with it. Don't automatically kiss people's ass. Have a disagreement, but explain why. That's my only thing. Okay. Rant over. Getting fired.
Wow.
Up today, Barry. Yes. So, Barry, guess what we haven't done in a while?
I'm going to guess it's F, Mary, Kill.
No, you're wrong. No, actually, you're right. I was just kidding. I saw a picture today, Barry, and it made me think, and we may have done a couple of these people, women before, but I'm going to do them, and I don't think we've done this order before.
All right.
So, Barry, F, Mary, or Kill. Now, we're talking, let's just say late 70s.
Okay.
Okay. So this is when all these ladies were definitely in their prime. Barry, Linda Carter, Lonnie Anderson, Jacqueline Smith.
Oh, all right. I think that one is, that's fairly easy for me. I think I'm going to say I'm going to kill Lonnie Anderson, mm-hmm. who doesn't really do anything for me. I am going to... I'm going to F Jack. I mean, like I would never have a shot with any women like this. I'm going to F Jacqueline Smith. And I'm going to marry Linda Carter because I could F her all the time, hopefully at that point, because she's my favorite by far. But all good choices. Lonnie Anderson never did a whole lot for me, I guess too plasticky, too phony. But boy, did I love me some Linda Carter and Jacqueline Smith too.
I would only say that I will reverse your marry and your fuck. I will take, I will marry Jacqueline Smith so I can have the opportunity for the rest of our time together to do that. And I'm going to F Linda Carter, a very beautiful woman, but yeah, Lonnie Anderson, you know, besides the whole plastic look to her, you know, after the Burt Reynolds debacle, there was a lot of baggage that came with that kind of came out about Lonnie Anderson. I seem to recall. So yeah, we're going to do it with her. Okay, Barry, now it is time for us to go to Starrcade 93, Charlotte, North Carolina. And we're going to look at Starrcade 93's match between Stunning Steve Austin with Colonel Parker against the young natural Dustin Rhodes. Barry, you've had a chance to watch this match. Tell us what you thought.
Absolutely, too. So I sat down yesterday and I watched this match. And, you know, it's I think the first thing that I got from this was really this is two more of Eric Bischoff's castoffs. Infamously, he got rid of Stone Cold Steve Austin, Chris Jericho, Dustin Rhodes left and went to the WWF, WWE. They all became big stars. Dustin was so good.
Wait a minute. I thought Eric Bischoff was a genius. How did that happen?
Eric Bischoff was one of the luckier people in professional wrestling. And I forget who it was, but he's been referred to as a con man numerous times by people that, and he really was. I think he was able to talk himself into positions. A lot of his decisions, he destroyed WCW. I think partly he got lucky. In a lot of ways, he stole a lot of gimmicks and, you know, a lot of the great stuff that WCW presented, at least in my opinion, was a lot of the cruiserweights, which were the guys coming over from Mexico, which they buried for the most part. That was filler to them and they buried. So, you know, I just not a fan of Eric Bischoff, but Dustin Rhodes was so good as the Natural. He was head and shoulders above what he was, at least in my opinion, is Gold Dust. And he was almost a Barry Windham light in some ways. You can definitely see the punches are similar. The movements of the ring are similar. I think Dustin really looked at Windham in pattern a lot of his early career after that. This, you know, interesting match. Jesse Ventura is on commentary. Jesse goes off on some sort of political comment about smoking and healthcare.
That's so unlike him.
Yeah, but it's so bizarre and so out of place. It's Rush Limbaugh. He's quoting Rush Limbaugh about smoking and healthcare during a Dustin Rhodes Steve Austin match. That makes no sense. Both these guys really, really great bump takers. And Austin takes this bump. He goes flying over the outside of the guard railing onto the arena floor and just literally goes flying and just hits with a thud on the floor. As you mentioned, Colonel Robert Parker, we know him as Robert Fuller, is the manager for Stone Cold or Stunning Steve Austin during this match. And I don't know if this was a good fit for the two of them. I think there definitely was a place for Colonel Robert Parker. I just think with Austin, it just doesn't work, at least in my opinion. Here's a very telling line. Tony Schiavone, who is commentating along with Jesse, has this quote, and it says, "Many people feel that you're looking at the two men who will dominate WCW in the next decade." Both men were gone literally within a year or so after this match, even a little bit less, I think. So, you know, to hear that comment, which was very accurate, which should have been very accurate, obviously Eric Bischoff didn't feel that way. But, you know, really, 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 really telling, at least in my opinion. Dustin's punches, top notch. Again, got a real serious Barry Windham style. He draws back. He lays them out. You know, just excellent stuff. First fall, it's a 2 out of 3 fall match. Dustin gets DQ'd for throwing Austin over the top rope onto Parker. The Colonel is then injured and is taken back to the dressing room. Austin gets split open and... I don't know. It looks like it's hard way for Austin, in my opinion. It's just a weird blade job if it's not. The lights go out. It looks like they're shining a spotlight on the ring. And that this is also indicative of WCW. It's just like, come on, guys, get your shit together. This wasn't happening in the WWF. You know, granted, the in-ring action was better in WCW, but production values, you know, come on, really a fucking spotlight. Austin then pins Dustin by holding the tights and he wins the U.S. title. And a couple of thoughts on this. It's the worst tight holding ever because he's doing it on the side and almost to the front in clear view of the referee. And the commentators, they make mention of the fact that the referee didn't see it. Well, how the fuck didn't he see it? Because there was the worst tight holding I've ever seen, but Austin then wins the U.S. title. And I wasn't aware that if somebody gets DQ'd, that they could still lose their title. So this match struck me as something like they were making the rules up as they were going along. That's kind of what I got from it.
Yeah. I gotta be honest with you. Two of the things you just commented on, I had made notations about too, about the two men that will dominate WCW, which I thought was especially ironic. And then the two straight falls, wait, wasn't there a DQ in there somewhere? a couple of things we had, Tony Schiavone and Jesse on the call of the match. I think it was Nick Patrick that was the third man in the ring bearer. Did you notice?
I'm not really sure, to be honest.
Okay. Yeah. So Jesse, Oh, apparently they had they showed at ringside, or there was some internet where the Hooters girls were there, and then he says to Tony, "Tony, do you think you can call any of those Hooters girls the natural?" And there was this dead silence from Tony, and then he says, "So what do you think, Tony? Natural or synthetic?" Which was hilarious. Yeah. And the how much, you know, it made Tony uncomfortable made it even funnier. So Austin in this match was doing stuff that you didn't see later on. He was doing like a dive over the top of the safety rail. This was, you know, you could see how great Austin was going to be. He was really rounding into shape here. And, you know, the stupidity of Eric Bischoff just knows no bounds, because you see this. How did you not see that this guy was friggin' awesome, that you should? And it makes it even more incredible that this guy comes in as the ringmaster in the WWE. I mean, the Stone Cold gimmick, basically his wife at the time helped him come up with that. But this guy was just money waiting to be made, and somehow they all missed it. I just don't understand it. Now, I'm going to disagree with you about something. I found, and I always felt, that Dustin Rhodes reminded me more of a young Dick Murdoch than he did a young Barry Windham, because so much it used to be kind of a joke amongst my friends that this he looked more like Dick Murdoch than he did his father. What did you think?
Yeah, well, he definitely had Murdoch's body. He didn't really have his father's body in Eddie, you know, neither does Cody. Cody doesn't look like either of them. When I go back to that comment I made about Wyndham earlier, that's really who he reminds me of. Even Murdoch, you know, yeah, he was tall and lanky, but he didn't have the gut. Dustin was in incredible shape at this stage. And I'm going to guess, what was Dustin wrestling here? 4 years, maybe 5 years max?
Let's see, 93. No, I think he started, because I know that he I had a Japanese magazine where he was touring in, like, I want to say 88 or 89.
Right. 89 is what I remember when he first showed up in Florida as well.
So then Jesse also with a great after a Dustin punch. What's the purpose of Dustin taping his knuckles, Tony? Then he punched the doll. I think we found out the purpose. Let's see. And then Colonel Parker with a great line at ringside. "You're a good for nothing, just like that old man of yours." I also noticed, and I mentioned it, he just throws a great looking punch, especially that one where the guy is doubled over. He slides down to the mat and punches him from underneath. That's a great looking move. As you said, the over the top rope, first DQ on the first falls where Austin gets color. The lights go out. You didn't mention what I thought was one of the all time great on the spot lines from Jesse Ventura. Jesse, always very quick. When the lights go out, he turns to Tony and says, "Hey, Tony, I guess this has turned into a dark match." And yes. I thought that was very clever and a very good. So, Austin becomes the new U.S. champ in this match. We appreciate Tom recommending this to you. So, Barry, what do you think? Great match, good match. What'd you think?
Good match, horrific ending that made zero sense. I don't think it elevates to a great match. These two guys are absolutely capable of having better matches, but it was just bizarre the way that it was booked. That first fall DQ, and then literally, I guess it's 3 minutes later that the tight pulling. It just, I don't know. There was something that was off with this match, and I think overall, it's kind of a disappointment, to be honest with you.
You know, when I was watching it, it was about 15 minutes in, and I had read what the result was. I'm going, wow, this is a 2 out of 3 fall match. So the ending seemed very rushed. The first 15 minutes of the match, I didn't have any problem with, but it just, you know, it seemed like, oh, hey, guys, instead of the half hour, we're going to only give you 20 minutes, so you need to wrap it up in the next 5 minutes. And all of a sudden, everything in the last 5 minutes is bing, 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 and it really came off forced. And I think it really affected it. I was a little surprised that I went back and looked at the rankings in the Observer. And for a match that Tom regarded so highly, Dave only gave this thing 2 stars. Now, that being said, the last thing I will say about this, Barry, this was the match, if I'm not mistaken, this was Flair Vader was the main event, which is a great match, by the way. But I started thinking about it. Was this, in fact, the last great?
Oh, I don't know. That I wouldn't be able to. I'd have to see the Starcade.
Because I started thinking, and, you know, of course, in the summer of 94 is when the Locust hit WCW, the Locust known as Hogan. And, for you know, after that, everything, you know, Beefcake comes in and, you know, all that other shit that implies. And to me, it really went downhill. Yeah, I did go, and I talked about it. I went and saw Flair and Hogan in Orlando at a pay-per-view that was very entertaining and a lot of fun. I think it was a bash at the beach. Matter of fact, we talked about that recently, I think. And that was a fun show. But, you know, things just with Hogan's influences really started going down. I really fell out of favor of WCW, which was kind of a shame because they were still having a lot of great matches. And then, of course, Bischoff comes in and decides he knows everything. And, well, we know how that story ends. So, so Barry, before we go any further, we now want to go to our interview with Larry Hamill. As you mentioned at the top of the show, Larry recently writing some rather incendiary comments regarding Orange Cassidy and his comparison to former NWA World Champion Jack Briscoe. So now, Barry, what do you say we go to our conversation with Larry Hamill? Okay, Barry, we are joined now by Larry Hamill. Barry, Larry is somebody that you've known for a while. Larry, a longtime wrestling fan that made some comments recently that caught the eye of our Arcadian Vanguard brother, James E. Cornette. Barry, why don't you say hello to Larry and tell us a little of the background here?
Yeah, absolutely, too. So I've known Larry for probably close to a decade, and Larry is a guy that grew up going to professional wrestling on the East Coast in a little town of O'Galley, which a lot of people know as Melbourne, or at least it certainly is close to Melbourne. And Larry was, it was really interesting as I collect all this wrestling memorabilia and all this stuff from the state of Florida. Larry actually began his literary career, his journalistic endeavors in writing for the old Milo's Mats when he was a young lad. I think he was 13 or 14 years old. Larry switched over and got a nice little paid gig at the Orlando Sentinel, worked for them for, I think, close to 20 years. And then in the mid-90s, he joined the Chicago Sun-Times as the Sunday sports editor. So Larry has a sports background. He's got a journalistic background and certainly knows professional wrestling. But Larry really got exposed, if I can use that word, Jeff, this past week when he was made quote unquote famous by James E. Cornette. And in a nutshell, Larry sent Jim a bunch of tweets that were in defense of Orange Cassidy, basically saying, hey, why don't you give him a shot? You know, he's more than what you see. He actually can do a lot. And Jim, apparently, according to the drive-thru, Jim cut him off after the first tweet and blocked him. And then Jim went on what we like to consider one of his epic rants this past week. So when I heard this, I was like, wow, that's a an ass kicking of epic proportions. And some of the quotes that Jim said, and we're going to bring Larry on in a minute to talk about this. Jim wants anyone who knows Larry to go knock on his door and tell him he's a fucking idiot. You've got, and Jim, I'm quoting Jim on this. You've got Alzheimer's, you're fucking senile. You're a daft cunt. And then Larry at one point had made a reference to Jack Briscoe. And Jim said, he reminds you of Jack Briscoe. He reminds me of a pus-filled pocket pussy. I don't think I've ever – I've got a visual now of something really disgusting. Used condom for brain Larry Hamilton. If you can produce some sort of paperwork, I'll make fun of you. But I'm going under the assumption that you're mentally diseased. Larry Hamill can go fuck himself, and I bet he's related to that fucking Dorothy Hamill. So
I'm not going to have anyone defame the great Olympian from 76, Dorothy Hamill, and her little haircut. So just to clarify before we start, Larry, are you related to Dorothy Hamill?
No, I'm not. In fact, it's a different spelling. An I-L, and I'm an
E-L. We've cleared that up, thank God. So, okay, continue, Bear.
However, she's famous for the Hamill Camel. Remember the spin thing she did, the spinning camel? When I was young, I was often called Hamill the Camel.
All right.
So we're not related or anything, but we have that in common.
Okay. But why don't you tell us where you were coming from with the whole comparison to Jack Briscoe kind of thing? And, of course, you saw Jack Briscoe in your youth, I'm guessing. So why do you feel this guy compares to Jack Briscoe?
Well, actually, I believe I might have seen Jack Briscoe wrestle in his first match in Florida in 1968 because Orlando was a Monday night town, and they usually started guys there on Monday and then ran them into the TV or something on Wednesday. So, yeah, I saw Briscoe. Here's that was taken out of context, and here's why. My original point with that is, and if you read the tweet, you can see that I wrote, I've never heard Orange Cassidy cut a promo, but he can work people into the building the way Jack Briscoe did. And here's why I said that. I don't believe anybody who has any history of wrestling would debate that Jack Briscoe isn't one of the most believable wrestlers of the kayfabe era. In fact, I rank him number one on my list of believability. And I've been watching this thing since probably 1964, dim recollections of the Kentuckians and the Assassins. But I certainly, as I wrote in my little essay on Twitter, you know, I did see on TV Eddie Graham knock out the great Malenko's dentures and stomp them into a million pieces on the mat. So I've been watching this thing a while. Jack Briscoe was a fabulous wrestler, and everybody who saw him would say that. He wasn't exactly known for talking people into the building. In fact, his work on the mic was kind of pretty dry, but it was the kind of promo that the humble babyface always used to make. So Jack Briscoe didn't talk anybody into the building. That's my point. I've never heard Orange Cassidy cut a promo. In fact, there are some videos out there that show that he really doesn't talk. But there has to be a reason why he's one of the biggest wrestlers, certainly on the independent scene on the East Coast. And trust me, I'm no expert on that. I can only tell because when you look at his list of videos up there on YouTube, when I did my due diligence, and unlike Jim, I did do due diligence before I wrote this. I wrote it for a reason. And I've been in the writing business now for 50 years, and I've written about a lot of stuff, including there's some stuff. If you look at Barry's fabulous Championship Wrestling from Florida archives page, you can see actually a column I wrote after the last Tangle in Tampa that was published in the Orlando Sentinel. Might have been the only thing that was actually written after the fact on the Tangle. Believe me, I won't cut a heel promo on Jim Cornette, because what he said when on his show, it's his show. He can say what he wants. I've been called a lot in my newspaper career, maybe not with quite the vehemence and the vile and the invectives, but I bet a lot of people thought it. So been in this thing a long time, and really the criticism like that rolls off my back like a duck on the water. But back to Orange Cassidy. And I'm not a fan of Orange Cassidy. That needs to be made clear. I saw Orange Cassidy on the second show that was on TNT that All Elite Wrestling did. And keep in mind, on the three shows that they broadcast so far, he's had, I believe, something like 3 seconds of airtime. But in those 3 seconds, the Best Friends, do you guys know who the Best Friends are? They put a video up on the screen of the Best Friends hugging, and then somehow Orange Cassidy kind of hangs out with them, apparently, and they cut to a picture, a shot of Orange Cassidy sitting down. And he has this trademark kind of half-hearted slacker thumbs up. And when they showed him on screen for those 2 seconds, my goodness, it was the biggest crowd response of the night. Do you guys watch AEW? Do you guys watch that at all? Are you
familiar? Yeah, I watch it. So just to clarify, you're not saying that Orange Cassidy is necessarily Jack Briscoe in the ring.
No, but he's a very good worker. He isn't Jack Briscoe in the ring, but there is something about him that has struck a chord with, obviously, the independent market, because he's not a kid. I found this out. Here's the challenge for finding out stuff about Orange Cassidy. There's virtually nothing out there on him on the internet other than videos. He doesn't even have a Wikipedia page. But on the really sketchy bio that AEW put out there about him, it made note that he's been wrestling for about 15 years, so he's not a kid. He's been doing this thing a long time on the East Coast and in other places. And so obviously to maintain that level of activity for that long, and he's popular with that audience, he figured out something. And his persona, if you don't really know what he is, he's a slacker. And here was a funny thing. When the great Brian Last, when he read my little essay, and that's what I'm going to call it. I'm a writer, been doing this a long time. When he read that and I used the word slacker, Jim didn't know what a slacker was. He said, "What's that?" And so Orange Cassidy is, in to use the vernacular of the modern kids, a slacker. He kind of wants to do things effortlessly, and he doesn't care, and he doesn't talk, and he doesn't respond. So if you look at the demographics of the modern wrestling audience, especially the ones that are going to pay money to go sit in a junior high gym and watch independents wrestle under, you know, 100-watt light bulb in the ring, what are the majority of those folks? Slackers, hipsters. You know, look at their videos and see the guy sitting in the front row. I guarantee you a lot of them are living in their mom's basement. He has found something that touched a nerve with that audience, and that has been one reason why I believe he's been effective in maintaining his career as long as he has. But in doing my due diligence, I reviewed a dozen matches of his, at least, and four or five of them are just pure comedy garbage. He doesn't do anything in them. But once he takes his hands out of his pockets, and if you're familiar with him, he wrestles with his hands in his pockets sometimes, and he can do amazing, some gymnastic thing. He can do a Matrix-like move. He can, when he gets hit, he can land on his back and do a kip-up right to his feet with his hands in his pocket. He's a pretty good athlete. He can be snap-mared over the opponent's shoulder and do a roll with his hands in his pockets right up to his feet. There's some kind of funny stuff out there on him.
Okay, so tell me, what do you think? If you're talking about that he's a slacker and that's his gimmick, compare him with, like, say, Matt Riddle from NXT. Because Matt Riddle kind of does a surfer guy. Hey, dude, yo. What do you think? Compare him to Matt Riddle.
I don't watch modern wrestling. I wrote in those tweets, I haven't watched modern wrestling in 10 years. I started watching AEW just to see if there was something on there that I might like, because I don't really have much use for modern wrestling. I find most of the stuff they do repetitious and boring. I don't understand how a guy can do a jump spinning five times off the top turnbuckle, hit three guys, they all fall down, and 2 seconds later, they're fighting as if nothing happened. Why do that? It doesn't make any sense to me. A lot of what they do doesn't make any sense. So I'm not a fan of modern wrestling. I don't know Matt Riddle from Adam. I didn't know Orange Cassidy from Adam until I saw this thing on the TV show that I watched and said, hey, there's got to be something to this guy. And that's when I went out and I watched a dozen of his matches, and four or five of them were just pure comedy. But there were four in particular that in which he really, once he stopped doing his little bit where he fake punches and fake kicks and all that, and he took his hands out of his pocket and he started wrestling, this guy knows how to work a wrestling match. And he doesn't really do it in the flippy way. You know, Jim Cornette uses that flippy as a derogative, which I believe too. He's a more conservative type once he actually starts working, but he can sell. He can sell like Ricky Morton. He can sell a lot like Jack Briscoe, and Jack Briscoe was a great seller.
Okay,
not saying he's Lawler, but he can wrestle. And the reason why he's been able to be popular, Barry and Jeff, is not just because he has this comedy bit thing that appeals to slackers and their sense of humor and their sense of irony, but once he actually gets working in a match, he can wrestle. And that's why I believe he has potential to be, God, Cornette's probably, if he heard this, he's probably
it's funny you mentioned that because what I was going to say was, why don't you, if you have a message for Jim, if you could talk to Jim, say, Jim, here's what I wanted you to realize.
Well, Jim, number one, I have amazing respect for everything you do and what you do have done in the business, and that you've been able to be as relevant, and he really is in the business long after his managerial career was over, through commentary and through the podcast that he does. And I have great respect for him. I didn't respect, you know, that he called me a lot of the names that he has, but I have great respect for him. And I believe that if Jim looked at the Orange Cassidy, once he takes his hands out of his pockets, he would see the same thing that I see. If All Elite Company worked this guy correctly, and I wrote this in my tweets, if they removed most of the obvious mockery of the business, and they let him just do like two or three of the kind of athletic stunts that he can do with his hands in his pockets and then work a match, this guy could be a breakout star for them. He really could, if it could go two ways. I don't know if he wants to do that because he's developed, and because he doesn't talk, he's developed a persona in the indies that he's been able to make money with for more than a decade. I don't know if he wants to change, but if he wanted to change, and if A&E wanted to present him in a way that retained much of his slacker appeal to the indie fan base, and then they put him in matches that actually showed, hey, I know how to wrestle a match. He's got this finisher, Barry, called the Mousetrap. It's a cradle, but it's a really tight cradle. He sticks his arm somehow and posts the opposite leg, pulls it in, and it looks as if the ref could count to five and the guy still wouldn't be there. Kind of, you know, like when the great Moolah as the Spider-Woman wrapped up Wendy Richter and in the Screwjob title change. I don't remember that. But it's like that. This guy can have a snug cradle. So what do we have here? We have a personality that doesn't have to cut a promo to be popular. We have a personality who has touched a nerve with a segment of its audience that is going to pay to see him. We have an athlete who can do some amazing things, isn't small. He's like 5'11", 190 pounds. That's big by all elite standards, really. So he'd be credible against bigger guys. And he is not a bad worker. In fact, I think he's a doggone good one. Once he starts wrestling.
All right, Larry. Hey, listen, we appreciate your time and your viewpoints. Again, you are certainly allowed to have your own viewpoints, though they may be different. I personally never seen the guy. So anyway.
Well, nobody's seen him. That's part of the thing. He's a blank canvas.
Yeah, exactly. So we appreciate your time, and we will speak to you again in the future. And thanks for joining us.
I hope so. Thank you, Barry.
All right, Barry. We want to thank Larry Hamill for joining us. Larry loves to talk, Barry. I don't know if you noticed that.
Yeah, Larry will have his own podcast coming up shortly. It'll be Me, Myself, and I with Larry Hamill.
I don't think it'll be on the Arcadian Network. I'm just throwing it out there.
Right. Could be. I don't know.
With Jim maybe Cornette, Jim will do a show, the Cornette and Hamill Hour.
I'll listen. I know that.
All right, folks. Now it is time for our top five Halloween movie recommendations. Barry has been hard at work at this. So have I. And we have a special guest top five that I will throw at you in a moment. So, Barry, why don't you tell us, what's your number five go-to? It's Halloween. You want to watch something that's either scary, creepy, whatever, monster movie. You got some popcorn. You're curled up on the couch in the basement in Ambler. What's your number five choice?
Absolutely. And I should say, I had a list and I whittled it down, Jeff. I had a list.
You're
of
a whittler.
I'm a whittler. I do it every time. I had about 35 movies, and Halloween is one of my favorite holidays. I love horror movies. I watch them year round. But when the month of October strikes, Jeff, I start to queue up all my movies, whether they're on DVR, DVD, or Netflix or Amazon or whatever, any streaming device I can get. And I love watching movies. So I picked out five that I have either watched already this October, or that I'll be watching in the coming weeks. And number five, Jeff, it's a no-brainer for me. It is the appropriately named Halloween, and it's the original from 1978, the one starring Jamie Lee Curtis, Donald Pleasence, and PJ Souls, directed by John Carpenter. And this was kind of the movie that obviously it put Halloween as far as being a an iconic horror holiday on the map for movies. It certainly spawned a lot of other movies, but this was also in some ways the birth of the slasher film. Michael Myers did come before Freddy Krueger, did come before Jason Voorhees, who was Friday the 13th. And this is such a great movie. And, I have a feeling everybody has seen this movie. In case you haven't, it's Halloween 1963. And little six-year-old Michael Myers brutally murders his 17-year-old sister, Judith. He was sentenced, locked away for 15 years. But on October 30th, 1978, while being transferred for a court date, 21-year-old Michael Myers steals a car, escapes, and returns to his quiet hometown of Haddonfield, Illinois, where he looks for his next victims. And of course, his victims are generally teens about to have sex.
Slutty teenagers. So that's what he goes after.
Yes. That's what he goes after. So, Jeff, you've seen the original Halloween, haven't you?
Well, I love the tagline when a movie originally came out. I saw it when I was in high school, The Night He Came Home.
Yes.
That's the way it was advertised. And yeah, it's just such a great, creepy setup. And there were so many things about this movie. And spoiler alert, it's on my list too. But the things that, to me, there were things that were implied that you never saw, you know, and a lot of the stuff that Friday the 13th shows, very graphically, that Nightmare on Elm Street shows very graphically. Halloween sort of implied it to you. And to me, it's always been, and I've stated this before, it's no big surprise, I like the implied violence more than the shown violence. And I know there are people out there, they want to see the head completely cut off. They want to see the sinew, the blood, all that kind of stuff. And if you do, more power to you. But I've always said that the mind and your imagination can imagine something far worse than what you see on a movie screen. You know, if you hear that, you know, axe or knife going in, but you don't actually see it, what you imagine's happening is always much, you know, worse in your mind than what you can actually see on the movie screen. So you know what I'll do? I'll take that and I'll make that my number five also, Barry, because that is, it's a great iconic horror movie, not just for Halloween, especially for Halloween, but it's besides just for Halloween. And Jamie Lee Curtis is really good as the virginal teenager. No big surprise. That's why she survives. And also, of course, the great Donald Pleasance as his psychologist.
Yeah, it's a fantastic movie. And I'll tell you, when the second one came out, I was very disappointed. And Halloween 3, The Season of the Witch, which doesn't—
complete garbage.
But see, that's it. It's such a polarizing film. Some people absolutely hate it and others love it. And I like it. I don't know if I love it, but I actually like it. Though when I first saw it, I thought the same thing. I was like, I fucking hate this movie.
Yeah. So often, you know, it's just a money grab. You know, sure. Was it, you know, Friday the 13th, part 9, Jason in Space, or I don't know if it was 10. It's just like getting a little ridiculous. You know, it's just like throw all the ideas in the first one and then let's just see if we can keep cashing in once a year on the other ideas and put a new actor under the mask. They did it with this movie, with the Freddy movies. With this stinking, Texas Chainsaw Massacre movie. The first one was so, it's not on my list, but that was such an iconic horror film. And so, oh my God, that was a movie that where you saw, you know, the violence that was happening. And it was so horrific because it was so completely out there at the time. But, you don't need to do 10, you know, different sequels to the original, because I think at that point, you're just kind of whoring out the film title at that point, Barry. So, okay, yeah. I used Halloween as my number five. What's your number four, Barry?
Gotcha. So my number four is going to be Frankenweenie, Jeff. So it is. Have you ever seen Frankenweenie?
Is that what you call it?
That's what any woman I've ever been with calls it. They call it Frankenweenie. Have you ever seen Frankenweenie?
I've not seen the movie nor yours.
Well, we're going to keep it that way too, Jeff, as we both start to approach our 60s. So Frankenweenie came out in 2002. It's an animated film from Tim Burton. And this is a movie that I've watched since the movie came out every year with my kids on Halloween night. And we get in our garage, we open up our garage, we put a TV in the garage, and we hand out candy as we're in the garage watching Frankenweenie, and we keep it on. And it's the kind of movie that young kids can watch. It's great. And really what it's about a little boy named Victor whose dog gets hit by a car and he dies. And he brings him back to life. And it's really a great movie. Tim Burton is such a great director on so many levels. And it mixes this heartfelt sentiment. We both love dogs. And it also adds in this great monster movie storyline. Martin Landau, who steals every movie he's in and up until his passing, and stole Ed Wood, in my opinion, as well. But Martin Landau steals the film. He plays Mr. Rizkruski, the science teacher, speaks in this thick European accent, and he's kind of the one that inspires Victor to bring Sparky, who's the dog, back to life. As it turns out, that character is actually inspired by Tim Burton's childhood hero, Vincent Price, and I can definitely see that. Critics love this movie. It has a Rotten Tomatoes score of 87%. And Frankenweenie grossed, I think worldwide, almost $82,000. So not one of Tim Burton's biggest movies. But if you've never seen it, there's something really unique about it because it's got this 1950s kind of monster vibe going. But at the same time, it's really a sweet story about this little boy who loves his dog, Jeff. And you and I can relate to that. And so Jeff's taking a bathroom break.
Yes, we can. No, we're here again.
All right.
It is my birthday. So, absolutely. We both love dogs, and we can certainly agree with that. My number four, Barry, I am going to 1976. You know, if there's one thing that the beloved Mrs. Bowdern hates in a horror movie, it's anything having to do with the devil. And anything having to do with the devil in this case, 1976's The Omen, has to do with what if the devil came back to Earth as a child. Gregory Peck, Lee Remick, in a movie that got a 7.5 on the old IMDb scale. Barry, one of the great all-time creepy movies about the devil, The Omen.
Yeah, I mean, my God, it's absolutely frightening, The Omen. And again, the first time I ever saw The Omen, too, and I think I saw it within a year or two at a drive-in with my parents, who had horrific judgment. My parents also, they did. God rest their souls, and I love both my parents. But my parents also took me to see The Exorcist at a drive-in when I was a kid growing up, and I must have been 5, 6, 7. I don't know exactly, but I was really young and I don't think I slept for a week. So horrific judgment on Mr. and Mrs. Rose's part. But The Omen was great. And that little kid, I don't know if he ever acted again other than The Omen sequels. Yeah. But boy,
his name was Harvey Stevens, the actor.
Is that it? Wow. Yes. I would have no idea. He was really frightening in that first Omen film.
Yeah, and you know, one of the iconic movie scenes of all time is at the end of the movie. Spoiler alert on the movie that's like 40-something years old is the scene at the end of the movie in the cemetery when the music from this movie is so iconic.
Yes.
But there's a scene where the camera does a close up on him, and he turns and he has this very sinister smile on his face. And the story goes that the director of the film, Richard Donner, when he was shooting the scene, told Harvey, the young kid, "Now, Harvey, whatever you do, don't smile. You better not laugh, Harvey. You better not laugh." So as the kid turned, the director was screaming, "Don't laugh, Harvey. You better not laugh." And of course, at that moment, that's when Harvey broke into that smile that is perceived as being so sinister. And that was the end scene of the movie, and it's fantastic. When and if you see it, if you haven't seen it by now, I don't know what you're waiting for, because this is a great movie. Barry, what would your number three Halloween movie be?
So my number three movie is a movie that I watched, I think it's two or three nights ago, this past week, and maybe it was Friday night. It was Friday night. It is my number seven favorite movie of all time. It is 1985's Reanimator, starring Jeffrey Combs as Dr. Herbert West, Bruce Abbott, and Barbara Crampton. This is such an iconic movie, and it's directed by Herschel Gordon Lewis, based off of a tale by H.P. Lovecraft. And essentially, it's about bringing dead people back to life, less about that, but more reanimating their bodies by injecting them with this kind of neon green serum. So I know I've told this story, and I think I told this either the first, second, or third episode, but the first night, actually, it was Friday night, and I know that, Jeff, it was three nights ago. That was the 34th anniversary of the release of the movie, and that's why I watched it. But I went on opening night in 1985, and I went with a girl that I had been dating for maybe, I'll say, a month or so. And it was a midnight showing in South Florida, and we were both under the influence, which is
what?
A nice
one.
Yeah, oh yeah, which really was. But there is a couple of scenes in the movie. There is one where a body is carrying its own head. Its head has been chopped off. This was a doctor, and he had his head chopped off, and he's walking around. The body's walking around carrying the head. Well, there's a girl on a table, and the body puts the head between her legs. Which is, you know, in 1985, that was like, holy shit. But there's also a scene at the very end, spoiler alert, where the bodies have been injected. They've over-injected with serum, and all the intestines start to come out and attack people. And I just remember sitting there, and I'm like, I'm fucking like just going nuts. I'm like, I can't believe this. And she's like going, calm down. Calm down. She's like, exactly. It was like I wound up having a relationship with her for 3 years, which is absolutely shocking, because when I look back at this, I could just sense like she was cringing at how excited I was at this movie. But if you've never seen Reanimator, it's not for everybody. It's a lot of fun. It's slightly cheesy at times, but it's highly unique. It's not your average horror movie.
All right. My number three movie, horror slash Halloween movie of all time, is Stephen King's 2017 movie, It. And, you know, there's a lot of people when you talk the genre of horror or a movie that you would like for Halloween, they go for the the slasher movies, the movies, you know, about the devil or a ghost or something like that. And the reason that I liked It so much is because the character of Pennywise preys upon things that scare each individual person. And that's what I thought was so brilliant about the movie, because we all have our own personal foibles and fears about this or that. And it's not, you know, every person is not scared of the same thing. If you took, you know, 15, 20 people, they're not all going to be scared of the same thing. Each one of us would have separate individual fears, you know, about different things. And that's what I found so fascinating about the character of Pennywise in It, was that he focused on each person's individual fears. And to me, that's what makes this movie, and the creepiness factor and the dread factor — I mentioned that when we first reviewed this movie — the dread factor to me always makes a movie so much more interesting and so much more scary, you know, than some guy walking around with a machete hacking off people's heads. That to me is just, you know, you're watching that just to see, oh yeah, look at the special effects. That's really cool. That's, to me, is boring, quite frankly. And, you know, but this, you know, the group of friends that bandy together in this small town of Derry, Maine, which, by the way, Barry, I think we can safely establish that if there in fact was a Derry, Maine, no one was going to want to live there, because I think every book Stephen King's ever written is about Derry, Maine and the terrible things that go on in this small town. But and certainly one of our favorites, Finn Wolfhard from Stranger Things, is in It. But It, a great movie, Barry.
Yeah, great one. Did you ever see the second?
I have not seen it. My daughter saw it. She said it was really good in a slightly different way, which I haven't seen it yet, so I don't know what she meant by that. But she enjoyed it. Not quite as much as the original, though.
Yeah, and my daughter as well, Jeff. My daughter saw the first one, and she saw the second one. She did say that the first one was better. I haven't seen it either, but I believe it might be on cable, or it's on some sort of on-demand pay-per-view deal. I definitely want to check it out during the Halloween season, though.
All right, so Barry, number two.
So my number two, Jeff, my third favorite film of all time, Return of the Living Dead. 1985's Return of the Living Dead, starring Beverly Randolph and a host of people that you probably have never heard of before. This is such a fun movie. It's a rock and roll horror film. It's a little different than the traditional zombie films, and I love zombie films. But this
spoiler is spoiler alert for next episode, Barry.
Oh, that's right. That's right. We are reviewing a movie for Halloween next episode. But this is a lot of fun. Rock and roll, horror, and the zombies are unique. And there's some really good acting. Clue Gulager, who we've talked about, is
the,
in this
the great Clue Gulager.
Yeah. And what was he in that I was just watching? I was watching a film. Oh, he's in Nightmare on Elm Street Part 2 or Part 3. There was a marathon on the other day that I was watching, and he was in that. But yeah, he's got some credits. Like, he's done, you know, 4,000 between TV shows and movies. I believe he's close to 90 years old right now. But he's in this movie, and it's a great movie. It's the difference here with the zombies, and they're not really zombies. I don't know if that's a fair title to call them zombies, but they can actually speak in this movie as well. So I love it. This is one that I have on the DVR. I've got the DVD, and I watch this one probably once every couple of months. I'll just put it on and I'll enjoy. Yeah, I love it. It's got a different vibe, and it's just a lot of fun. And the soundtrack is aces.
All right. My number two favorite Halloween slash horror movie is from 1973. Director William Friedkin William Peter Blatty's book, The Exorcist, which is the story of the possession of a young girl in Washington, D.C., Reagan, and her mother calls upon two priests to see if they can go outside the bounds of the Catholic Church and perform an exorcism on her 13-year-old daughter, Linda Blair. The Exorcist is one of the all-time holy shit movies, Barry. I think you'll agree with that. Solid 8.0 on the IMDb scale.
Yeah, as I just mentioned too, it was I think it scarred me when I was younger, because I really was. I couldn't sleep for days. I was totally freaked out, and seeing Linda Blair with the head spinning and your mother sucks cocks in hell and all that shit that she was doing. And that was just a frightening aspect.
Would you like to talk to her, Karis?
You go back and you watch this movie now, and if you do, it holds up extremely well. Yeah. Linda Blair was she was mesmerizing. Reagan, right? Her name was Reagan in the movie. Just absolutely mesmerizing in that role. I would say this is one of the most iconic horror films in the history of horror.
Yeah, if you are a movie fan of horror as a genre and you have not seen The Exorcist, you are not truly a horror movie fan, because this movie is like I have something else at number one that's sort of a little different type, but this movie belongs on it. You know, I talk often about my top 10. I also have a top 25, and I think this movie is in my top 25 because, first of all, technically, it's so brilliant. Some of the mood, some of the set designs, the acting, incredible cast, Ellen Burstyn, Max von Sydow, Lee J. Cobb, you know, so many great actors. And Linda Blair, like you said, and Jason Miller as Father Karis, the priest.
Yeah.
Just so many great performances. And, you know, the scene where she goes out in the dinner party and starts taking a leak right in front of her mom's friends is just so crazy. So, just a great, great film that absolutely should be seen. And I'll try to talk my wife into watching this movie during Halloween season. And she will, of course, say absolutely not. So, Barry, what's your number one favorite Halloween horror movie?
My number one, Jeff, Nightmare on Elm Street. So I'm going back to the original.
I mean, the movie I just shit on.
So, well, I think you were shit. Yeah, in a sense. But this is the original from 1984 that Wes Craven directed. This had such an impact on me when I saw it, because A, the acting was really good. John Saxon, who in a bunch of Bruce Lee movies, and just a really solid actor, and I believe still around, like 85 years old. This movie has it all, but it introduced us to Freddy Krueger. And he's obviously become an iconic horror figure, like the people that I mentioned earlier. But this being the first film, and this was one of the later ones, again, you know, Michael Myers was 78, Friday the 13th with Jason Voorhees, 1980. This was 84, actually going into 85. And, you know, the whole backstory of his mother being raped by all these, you know, all these men, and he's the bastard child of all these criminals, and, you know, and he's horribly burned. But the story was also really different, you know, unlike, say, Michael Myers or Jason Voorhees, this whole thing where he comes to people in their dreams and will kill them, you know, it just, and that whole bladed glove, to me, was just so unique. So I loved it. I wasn't a fan of a lot of the sequels initially. I watch them now, maybe a little different appreciation for them. But at the same time, when they first came out, I wasn't a fan. But I can go back and I can watch the original, and I could probably, you know, watch it for 31 days in the month of October, because I think it was groundbreaking on so many different levels. Interesting story too. Heather Langenkamp, who I think went on to have a TV career. I forget what TV show she was on, but she was on a show for years. But she had auditioned for the female leads in both Night of the Comet and The Last Starfighter, which are two movies that we've discussed here previously. She lost both to the same person, who's Catherine Mary Stewart. And those are two of my favorite movies as well. So, Jeff, the original Nightmare on Elm Street, I think it's as good as any horror film out there.
Okay, well, maybe I will avail myself, since I can honestly say that that's when I've never watched the entire movie, because I'm just, not really a big fan of that. But I will take a chance and I will watch the full movie and give my report back. Now, before I go with my number one sort of outside the box choice, Barry, a movie that we have discussed before, but I'll discuss it again. Went to another movie fan. Because, you know, as I sat there and looked at my list, I was like, I really only have one movie here from the last few years. And I know we've got movie buffs out there. We've got Halloween nuts. like to do a little cosplay for the Halloween, not going to mention any names. So I figured, you know, they're going to want to hear the voice of a generation that likes more current movies. So as I placed a phone call to my beloved daughter, Kelly, horror movie buff that she is, Bear, and I said, give me your top five movies that you and your husband, by the way, they just celebrated their 1 year anniversary, Barry. So happy anniversary to my daughter and her husband. Oh. So I said, you're sitting around, it's Halloween. What movies are you sitting around watching of a horror nature with a bucket of popcorn, you and the hub? What are you watching? So she said, well, first of all, let me just say that any Halloween season, our ritual, our standard bear, we start off with The Nightmare Before Christmas. That's a big movie in their household. They love that movie. So that starts, that's the preamble to her top five. Her top five then goes, Barry, you check off, tell me which one of these you've seen.
Sure.
The Conjuring.
Yes, I've seen it.
With Fan? Yes or no?
One and two.
No, sorry. Did you see Conjuring 1?
I did.
Okay. Thumbs up or thumbs down?
Thumbs up.
Okay. The Conjuring 2, Mr. Spoiler, jumping on my spot there.
Sorry.
Did you see Conjuring 2?
I did.
Which one did you like better?
I actually like Conjuring 1 better.
Okay. Next, she said a movie I mentioned, It, she was a fan of. Then she said Saw.
Oh, Saw. I've seen every Saw movie. Absolutely. Okay.
Yes, I saw the first one. The first one was excellent. Very well done. I haven't seen the multitude of follow-up movies to it, but I can say that I did see the original Saw. That was a very good movie. I really enjoyed that. But her number one, and what I thought was especially kind of funny, because you know everybody knows I go by the IMDb scale, the fact that of all the movies she picked out, I went and checked all the ratings to see what they got. And The Conjuring, I think, got like 7.5. Conjuring 2 got 7.4, something like that. It and Saw, very well rated. Her number one favorite horror movie got the lowest rating of any of her choices on IMDb. Barry, have you ever seen The Nun?
I have not.
Okay, well, that was Miss Kelly's favorite Halloween movie choice. So some movies from like most of them, I think, within the last 5 years. So there for you younger listeners, throwing you guys a bone. That's her choices. So she would recommend those five movies, plus, of course, the extra The Nightmare Before Christmas as a little extra. So now, Barry, it's time for my number one. My number one movie, we have discussed it before, Barry, that is The Vanishing. The Vanishing is an incredibly fascinating movie to me, Barry. It came out in, why can't I see this, 1988. It's a movie from I believe, Holland or Norway. Jeez, I probably should know that. But it gets 7.8. And it's, you know, we talked about movies about slashers, about the devil, you know, ghost, whatever. Here is a simple story about a young couple that are on vacation that stop at a rest stop or a rest area on the highway. The woman goes in to, I believe, use the bathroom or go get something to drink while her husband or boyfriend is, I don't know, sitting in the car or putting gas in the car, something like that. And the woman disappears. There is no sign of her. She's gone. Her boyfriend is putting out signs, flyers all over different towns. This is, of course, set in Europe, trying to find the woman. And they literally find no trace of her. She's disappeared without a trace. And the boyfriend is losing his mind because he wants to know what happens. When finally he gets a letter from someone saying, I know what happened to your girlfriend. Do you want to know? And this person who is incredibly sinister because he is so incredibly normal. And there was a remake that was done, I think, with Kiefer Sutherland.
Yeah,
maybe was it Sandra Bullock that played his girlfriend? I'm not sure about that, but the lead heel was Jeff Bridges.
Yeah.
And it was a good movie, but it's not as good as the original. The original, if you could put up with the subtitles, I encourage you to go out of your way to watch this, because the last scene of the movie, I'm telling you, will stay with you for a long, long time, Barry.
Yeah. When did we discuss this with our favorite foreign films?
Yeah, I think we did, which must have been like 50 episodes or so ago. It was a while ago, but it's so good that I recommend, because it will really creep you the hell out.
Yeah, it was great. It was and I think and the one with Kiefer Sutherland and Jeff Bridges is actually really good. It's just unfortunate because you're always going to compare it to the original. And then it's just not quite as creepy as the original one was.
Yeah. So anyway, there you go, folks. We didn't give you just 10, not two top five lists. We gave you three top five lists
yep.
of movies that we would offer
bonus.
Up to you. That's what we're all about. We're all about caring for the people, Barry. Yep. So as we begin to wrap up, Barry, anything to say before the go home, my friend?
Lou and I can sing again to you if you want.
Okay, I'm ready to go to my birthday dinner. Going to Ruth's Chris tonight, Barry.
Oh, what are you going to get?
I'm going to go for the chicken, Barry. What do you fucking think I'm going to get?
Oh, you're not going to get the fish? Not going to get the trout?
Let me have a nice catfish here.
Exactly.
So, folks, I would encourage you to follow me on Twitter at Bowder and Jeff, Breaking Kayfabe, a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. My book, They Call Me Booker, still available at Crowbar Press. Knock on his door, Scott Teal at Crowbar Press, and say, by God, I need to help Bowder out. It's his birthday. I want his book. Buy the second one, Dinners with the Legends of Wrestling. I would encourage you to do that one also. Until then, we want to thank our man, Sweet Lou Kippelman. Sweet Lou, the Kip, they call him, on the duties there. And we appreciate you doing the producing, Lou, the great Brian Last on the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. And until next week, folks, happy birthday to me. Sing me out, Barry.
Happy birthday to you. That's it. Cut myself off.
Later, folks.